for me to be here today. You have no idea, or many people have an idea, that I have postponed coming for quite some time. So in spite of having close collaborators, friends over here, it just happened. So I'm very, very pleased to be here this afternoon. And in particular, I'd like to thank Liz Molly, because he's the one who extended an invitation back in the fall. And finally, that kicked me and made me come here. So, well, of course, there is also a little bit of a disadvantage in being in a place where so many of you work in my same field. Usually, when I think to putting together a colloquium, I like to have the idea that, yeah, we start talking about things that we all know very well, but it's always a pleasure to revisit. But then I hope to move on to things that presumably have to do with my research, so I know better than you do. And maybe in the end, there will be some time to touch upon questions that nobody knows the answer for yet. Well, that's the usual thing I have in mind. It remains to be seen whether there is anything at all that I will be able to say that you don't know already. So let's see how it goes. So the story I have picked for today to entertain you with is about entanglement, as you can see. And in particular, there is one fact that I would like to take as a starting point and stress about entanglement. That is the fact that it is not an absolute property, but rather a relative. You see, I have an observer dependent in my title. And that is what I want to build up upon. In particular, what I want to try to do is to argue that by acknowledging, or better say, by understanding where this relativity of the notion of entanglement comes from, and how to try to capture and explore the consequences, leads us quite naturally to an enlarged framework for entanglement. We call this generalized entanglement, G for short. And I am saying we because this is actually a story that is relatively old by now. It started, you heard from Daniel that I was in Los Alamos, I was not the only one. This story started in 2002 under the New Mexican sun. A bunch of people were all together there. Now we are scattered in different places, in particular Howard Barnum, Manny Neal, Gerardo Ortiz. And over time, this idea has ramified in different directions. It has involved more and more people. Some of those people I'm sure you know very well. And in particular, some of these people are even here, although Rolando Soma, I think he's in Argentina these days, so he's not here, but virtually here through the results that I am going to mention. He certainly have had a very, very important role in that. But so that's the kind of program. And let me just, as I said, the colloquium should be nice and easy. Let's start together revisiting the early days of entanglement. Also because I've mentioned the word relative, relativity to all of us physicists, relativity immediately calls to mind the name of Einstein. Well, entanglement and Einstein did have a lot to do with each other in the early day, although not exactly in the way perhaps that Einstein might have envisioned. And well, I am referring, of course, to the famous EPR paradox. We are back in 1935. And the EPR dilemma, just of course you all know about this, but let me just pictorially, here is the how to revisit that in the spin 1/2 version, which is actually due to David Bohm. And the Gedanken experiment that was envisioned was kind of having like a particle which would, let's say, spontaneously decay with total angular momentum zero in the beginning, decaying in two spin 1/2 fragments or particles that would be flying in opposite direction. And then we have our friends, Alice and Bob, one of them being specialized in measuring the spin component of one particle flying right, and the other specializing in measuring the spin component of the other particle flying left. So problem being that because Alice would be allowed to measure, to make any measurement of any spin component in her own basis, that would, thanks to the kind of correlation which are built in the modern terminology, we would call this a spin singlet, of course, and it would enable perfect anti-correlation of spin measurements in arbitrary bases. So thanks to that, and thanks to the fact that Alice would be able to perform measurements of arbitrary X, Y, Z components, then she would be able to predict with certainty the value of any possible measurement that Bob would do. And following the EPR argument, this would force to attribute an element of physical reality to the three non-commuting observable associated to the spin components. And that was a little bit of a problem because following, again, this reasoning, it would either have to be that quantum mechanics no longer offers a complete description of physical reality, or the only other alternative that EPR could envision would be to basically give up locality, as Einstein was really pushing for in special relativity, so he was not willing at all to do it, and accept somehow the idea that space-like separated measurement process could come to influence one another by means of the famous Pookie action at a distance that we all know from those days. Well, 1935, same year, another landmark paper, of course. Erwin Schrödinger, in response to his paper, was actually pointing out that there would be kind of another way out of this dilemma. And the way I like to think of it is like the only thing you have to really give up is the kind of classical reasoning that is implicit in the EPR argument of thinking to how the whole relates to the parties in a quantum setting. So in this paper, which, by the way, I like to quote because it's the one where the word entanglement, Verschränkung in German, was introduced, Schrödinger was arguing that this is the point that whenever one has complete expectation catalog, that was the language that he was using, and maximum total knowledge of psi function for two completely separated bodies, then obviously one has it also for the two bodies together, but the converse is not true. Maximal knowledge of a total system does not necessarily include total knowledge of all its parts, not even when they are fully separated from each other and at the moment they are not influencing each other at all. Now you see that some words here are actually in red, and the reason why they are in red is because I will come later to argue that it is this comparison between kind of a maximal and a non-maximal amount of knowledge, amount of information that we might have about a quantum state that in some sense is also underlying the formulation of generalized entanglement. And in some sense, I'd like to recognize that already here in Schrödinger words, but I leave this up to your judgment for soon. For now, well, in these same years, Schrödinger will also clearly state that he would not call entanglement one, but the characteristic trait of quantum mechanics, so the one that enforces the entire departure of the quantum from classical. Nevertheless, it took people quite some time, physicists for a long while, until at least John Bell came up with a formulation that was able to capture the local realistic picture behind the EPR argument into the form of some testable inequality. It took a while to physicists to stop looking at entanglement with suspicion or even embarrassment. So the perception has been shifting a lot from 35 to 64 is the year when John Bell formulated the first set of inequalities. And shortly after, already in the 70s, but here I have been mentioning as the probably first relatively conclusive experimental demonstration of violations of Bell inequalities, the famous experiment of Aspect, and I'm sure that many people here recognize this is one of the figures in their physical review letter papers where they emphasize very clearly these are data for correlation experiment for entangled photon pairs that they were checking, and they emphasize very clearly that these are experimental points with some error bars, which are order of 1 and 2%, and these are not fits to the data, but this is actually the quantum mechanical prediction. So that was, of course, those of you working in Bell inequalities and this kind of stuff, there are loopholes. You have to be careful in making conclusions out of this experiment. Nevertheless, the indication was quite strong that, well, nature would not quite follow the local realistic view of the original EPR setting, and rather might well obey very well quantum mechanics. Now, 82, starting from that, I take it that as the benchmark under which entanglement really became like an experimental kind of reality. Of course, this experimental reality has been consolidated a lot in the years that followed. And under the impetus of quantum information science and implementation of quantum information, of course, we have also witnessed, and we are witnessing a lot of efforts for being able to generate and control and detect entanglement in a variety of devices under as controlled conditions as we can hope for. And just I put together two emblematic pictures here. This is probably a very, very famous one, which is taken from Paul Quiat's lab. And these are two cones where the coincidence between entangled photon detection signal from parametric type 2 conversion was first demonstrated. And it allowed to have a very comparative to the existing one, strong high intensity source of polarization entangled photons, which in turn allowed people to verify, or better I should say, invalidate the Bell inequalities with lot of accuracies beyond, like, say, 30 or even 100 in some experimental run standard deviations. So, to the best of what we can say today, quantum mechanics sees, kind of the correct experimental description of reality as far as these facts go. And I was also trying to look for what is the state of the art in device technologies for having demonstrated that controlled production and characterization of entanglement. And well, this is a picture that is taken from data from Innsbruck, Rainer Blatt group, where demonstration of scalable multiparticle entanglement in trapped ion devices has been demonstrated for up to 8. In this case, ions, and this is a particular tomographic reconstruction of a so-called W state with a relatively good fidelity of 70-something percent. And there are 6 photon GHz ion states, and I'm not an experimentalist, but people are definitely putting a lot of effort into trying to characterize, as I say, as well as possible, maximal, no maximal entanglement, and detecting, and so on and so forth. So, coming really close to our days, of course, these experimental investigations, they have been parallel, and they are parallel, but by a lot of investigation on both the qualitative, the quantitative aspects of entanglement. So, I think it's fair to say that these days, entanglement is right there at the heart of quantum information science, following the discovery of teleportation and dense coding protocols. We know it is really the defining resource of communication. We don't know the full story as far as what the role of entanglement in computation is, but certainly it does play a quite vital role in quantum speedup as well. And it is also a probably not indispensable, but very useful resource for getting us to unprecedented levels of sensitivity in various metrological applications. And finally, something which I find very interesting, entanglement and entanglement theory are starting to branch out into different subfields of physics for people who didn't used to think in information theoretic terms, like condensed matter physicists. They are starting to use tools and notions, and there is a lot of work which is happening at the interface between quantum information and quantum statistical mechanics, plus, of course, a very important development also involving entanglement at the border with quantum foundations. So, lots of work, lots of properties that have been understood. Perhaps we have learned everything. Perhaps there are no more surprises. Perhaps entanglement has become routine. Is that the case? Well, I wouldn't be so sure, because one indication probably that there is still something important that we might have to learn about entanglement is the fact that if I were to ask you or every different researcher what is entanglement, I'm pretty sure that I wouldn't get exactly the same definition from everybody. And indeed, I was collecting different ones. You can find that some of them are in the review paper by Dagmar Bruce. Just to say that our view and understanding of entanglement is still pretty much evolving. And I don't think we have a final definition here. And having made that disclaimer, I take the liberty of adding the definition that I'd like to push here and explain a little bit. And that is, as I said, to stress the fact that it is a relative property that quantum states have. And it is a property, as I will try to explain much better now, that is fundamentally a consequence of our limited abilities for finding out about state themselves in the way that we can observe and in the way that we can control them. So let me start again from another beginning. This is a technical beginning, and let me revisit the usual definition. The standard entanglement definition is up here, joint state of composite system that we are unable to express as products or mixture of, if we are dealing with mixed states, of states of that individual subsystem that constitute a composite quantum system. Now, the kind of fascinating things about entanglement in some sense is, like, from the mathematical point of view, it seems like a very natural and a very innocuous property, because if, for instance, we look at just a bipartite case, we have our friends here, Alice and Bob, well, if we look at the direct product space, that simply has not a structure of a linear vector space. It is not closed. So if we want to insist to have a linear structure, so if we want to have linear superposition principle in place, well, then we have to look at the tensor product as the minimal structure that works. And in that moment we do that, we naturally have entangled states to appear, mathematically speaking. So here are the famous ones involved. I will use Bell states also in the following. But the kind of obvious and implicit point that is hidden here is the fact that a priori, if we start with a quantum system which is described in terms of its own Hilbert space, the way in which we might want to partition it into pieces, the way in which the whole might be divided up into parts, need not be unique. Now, physically, this is also a rather obvious point. It's a lesson that, for instance, particle physicists know very well, in the sense that different degrees of freedom, different structure, different particle might reveal themselves at different observer-dependent energy scales. Or if you don't want to go that far, let's stay with an introductory quantum mechanics example that everybody teaches to sophomore students. Basically, in treating a two-body problem like hydrogen atom, we always move to the center of mass coordinates that can factor itself exactly out. It's a degree of freedom that is a perfect tensor product with respect to the relative particle degree of freedom. If we were insisting into describing the complete wave function for electron and proton in the original coordinate of the system, well, the problem wouldn't look so simple. It wouldn't be factorizable. And staying with an example, which is, again, here I have Alice and Bob, four-dimensional Hilbert space. Let me imagine that I change the rule of the games. Let me imagine that, for instance, for whatever reason, the degrees of freedom I am interested, I have called these C and D. And this has to do with whether we have a phi or a psi type. And this is kind of a parity, degrees of freedom, plus and minus. Then if I look at this factorization of the same four-dimensional Hilbert space there, clearly, what happens is that what previously were the Bell state, maximally entangled in the standard definition, they will turn into product states, and conversely, there will be product states in the original factorization A and B that would become maximal entangled states. You can say, well, okay, point well taken, this certainly might correspond to a global change of basis, fine. All I want to stress here is that the notion, the usual notion of entanglement is relative in itself, and it is unambiguously defined only once we have picked a specific preferred way to break the Hilbert space into subsystems. That's the usual thing, Hilbert space is tensor product. So, what I would like to entertain is, well, we have acknowledged it is a relative concept, but is it really relative to subsystems in the most general sense that we might want to capture from both a quantum information and a physical point of view? For instance, here in these slides, I have picked up two situations. They are not the only one, but two situations where it might be kind of problematic to identify a preferred Hilbert space tensor product decomposition that we need in order for making the notion of entanglement unambiguous. The first one, on which I have to declare I'm not an expert in this, but this is enough, this is as much as we need to make sense of it. Suppose that a notion of subsystem can still be kind of formulated, but the mathematical framework that you want to use is no longer the ones of ordinary quantum theory, Hilbert spaces, but you want to work in a more general formulation, which is relevant to quantum foundation studies in the context of what even people here study a lot has to do with so-called general probabilistic theories. In those settings, it is possible to have a natural notion of a system being a subsystem of another, but there is a whole manifold of different inequivalent tensor product construction. There are maximal and minimal tensor product definitions. And the general notion of a state space is not a Hilbert space, but is rather something that mathematicians call convex cone setting, of which ordinary quantum theory is a specific example if we basically take state space as being associated to the positive operator, which are a subset of the Hermitian one, and we identify the distinguished functional that is needed in order for convex cone setting to make sense with just the trace. So we get the set of density operator, and that is ordinary quantum theory. But enlarging the mathematical formulation of entanglement to something which can encompass all general probabilistic theory is something very desirable and something which can have implication. It cannot be done with the usual notion. Even or possibly more compelling from a physical point of view is the case where a natural, physically natural tensor product decomposition might not exist at all due to the fact that one has indistinguishable quantum particle, and as a consequence, we might be in a situation where the role of indistinguishability and non-trivial quantum statistics might restrict the physically relevant state space not to be a tensor product, but just to be a subspace of Hilbert space. So this has been this has originated a lot of debate and a lot of work, actually, in the quantum information condensed matter community. What does it really mean for indistinguishable particles, bosons, fermions, to be entangled? What is entangled in the first place? For instance, I will focus and say more on that, on fermions in particular, in which case the requirement for statistics is total antisymmetry under particle exchange. So we have to consider the antisymmetric sector of the Fock space for the system. And for two fermions in two modes, which is an example that I will revisit later, what we end up having is states which are of this form, later determinant. So is it like entanglement of the fermions, even though there is no natural tensor product space associated to the particles themselves, so the particles really aren't the proper subsystems to consider? Is it entanglement of modes, position, momentum, whatever set of modes? And what if at some point, as it often happens in condensed matter problems, you decide to make a transformation which takes you, for instance, from fermion operators to spin operators or something else. Jordan Wigner mappings change in an isomorphic way the language, the operator language of the problem. Would you like your notion of entanglement to change with the language, or would you rather have it as depending on something else? This is the kind of question that different people have looked at with different answers. And we'll revisit this problem later on. For now, as I said, let's entertain the idea of looking for something a little bit more general, which is this generalized entanglement notion. Of course, whenever you attempt a generalization, you certainly need and want to be able to recover whatever you have already as a special limiting case under conditions that you know. So this is going to be prerequisite number one. Other desirable properties that we will try to incorporate in this generalized approach is the possibility to have a definition which is directly applicable to arbitrary operator languages, irrespective of them having to do with distinguishable or indistinguishable degrees of freedom, and more generally, something which can incorporate physical constraints, like due to statistics, but also due to superselection rules, or whatever other limited means you might have for observing and manipulating the system in a more or less naturally natural physical way. Now, I will give you the mathematical definition in the next slide. The physical intuition that lies behind the whole construction is just to acknowledge that even for standard entanglement, and let me get back to the Bell states that I was using before, if I have a pure unentangled state, that state is pure and remains pure also to a local observer. So Alice and Bob, they are restricted only to local observation and manipulations. So any pure entangled state remains pure. Whereas another equivalent characterization would say that a maximal entangled state is actually maximally entangled is to say that an observer who only has access to expectation values of local observable cannot practically conclude whether he or she has been given the entangled pure state or really has a mixture of the two components. So this is the intuition that I'm going to try to generalize, that is that entanglement can be locally indistinguishable from a mixture, but because I don't want to have subsystem and tensor product, I will try to change the definition of locality to something which is mathematically more general. So in some sense, we'll bypass, although I want to recover that in some situation, the need for tensor product decomposition, and instead define what I call the observer here is directly a set of expectation values for physical observables, and the generalized entanglement picture will come out essentially from the comparison between what an observer having unrestricted access and an observer having just restricted or local access to the system will be able to conclude. So, how to do that, mathematically speaking, what we want to essentially achieve is to translate the degree of how much we are mixed relative to some observable set into loss of extremality with respect to that same set. Now I'm talking about a set. This set in general is denoted by omega, and I have to say that depending on how much mathematical structure you give to this omega, you are going to be able to say or to make stronger or weaker conclusion in the corresponding theory that is going to be developed. So in the most general case, this omega only has to be like a linearly closed subspace of observables. So what we want to do is basically two steps. Given the distinguished set, you can introduce a notion of a reduced state, which again is not relying on tensor product decomposition, is not the usual partial trace by which you discard degrees of freedom. But one way to think of it, and this is not completely mathematical rigorous, but I think it gives the idea, we can think about states in Hilbert space. So we take a pure, and I will focus from now on starting with pure states in Hilbert space. And when I say state, I will interchangeably think state vector or the associated one-dimensional projector associated to it. So forgive this slight confusion here. I think two states and density operator the same way. So start from a state which is defined in Hilbert space. So we have the corresponding one-dimensional projector, which is the corresponding density operator. And I can view this as a positive linear functional on arbitrary operators in Hilbert space, simply in the way we all know. Is my pointer visible or not? I think it's not, right? Yeah. So I will move to the classical point and then, okay. So we were talking about this one here. And we can, it turns out that is a mathematically well-defined notion of a reduced state by simply restricting the domain of the functional lambda to the preferred set of observables omega that we have. Now, for all the states in Hilbert space, if you do this restriction, you are left with a set of reduced states. Turns out that this set of states has naturally a convex structure, and that is as much as you need to talk about the notion of extremal and non-extremal. And in terms of the set omega and the reduced states, what we put up as a definition of generalized, well, unentanglement, that's easier to give, we said that if we start from a pure state, psi in Hilbert space, we call it unentangled relative to the omega observer, relative to omega, if the reduced states remain pure, if the reduced state remains extremal. Otherwise, if it loses extremality, well, there is a degree, there is a certain amount of generalized entanglement whose degree is determined precisely by the expectation values of the, I'm saying expectation values because I'm taking the trace functional here of the distinguished observable. So that's a mathematical definition, and that is the qualitative definition of it. How to quantify? Well, okay, that's not exactly practical. It's too big. Okay. Maybe anybody has a pointer or something else? Yeah. Anyway, you would like of you would like to have a way for quantifying? Yes. Sorry.
There are two separated observers, like in the traditional situation. Should we be thinking of omega as the observables pertaining to just one of the observers? Or some combination of the observables for both of them?
For now, I am just envisioning the situation where if you like, there are always two observers. One is the one for no restriction whatsoever on the operator on a given Hilbert space, and the other is instead one where there is a restriction, which ideally should be dictated by the physics of the problem.
So I think the question was, in the case where we have the bipartite, entanglement, what is omega?
Is it just Alice's observables, or is it some?
Bipartite. Bipartite in which sense? Because I'm not going to define bipartite in terms of having.
I'm just trying to get an intuition to help to follow your general general discussion. So but just if we apply it.
I will recover the usual bipartite case in a second, in the next slide. Yes, I'm sorry. I did not. Maybe we're done, and then if the question is still there, I'm going to hear it after these slides. So, because that's the first check to do. So for now, what I wanted to stress is that you might also want to quantify, in addition to defining, what this degree of generalized entanglement you have might be. There is no unique way for doing it. There is never a unique way for quantifying entanglement, and this is no exception. But one natural way to do it in the case, here I'm going to specialize omega, to not being arbitrary, but being actually with some mathematical structure, which is a Lie algebra, acting irreducibly in the Hilbert space. In that case, that this is not a fundamental restriction, but is a convenient one because it allows you stronger results to be proven. And under that assumption, one can quantify the degree of generalized entanglement relative to, in this case, when omega is a Lie algebra, I use H for that Lie algebra. Just taking a Lie algebra is also a subspace, so it will have a basis of operators. We can take that basis to be orthogonal and Hermitian. And the notion of projecting onto a subspace is well defined, so we can take the length, geometrically speaking, of the projector, of the projection that the given psi has onto the subspace, and normalize the corresponding number in such a way, this is always a positive number, it has a minimum and a maximum, and we can normalize it in such a way that it gives us one for the states that we deem to be unentangled relative to our observer. Now, the idea here is, like, remember, even in the usual definition, the states which are extremal, they are going to be unentangled. So extremality, which means the longest projection onto the algebra, will correspond to maximum value of this functional here. Yes, Yosha.
In the particular case where omega is the set for
which will
operator,
in the next,
then they're all extremal?
Yes, indeed. That is one thing that will come exactly in the following. That's why I needed a measure to talk about for going through the example. That's going to be the last mathematical slide. So this is as far as getting a number to associate to the amount of entanglement. The other nice result that one can prove
when the distinguished observable are not just arbitrary, but they are in the algebra, you can prove that the unentangled, the family of unentangled states is actually a family which is well known to mathematical physicists because it is the family of generalized coherent states of the group that the Lie algebra generates. And this, in addition to this being computationally nice, it is also conceptually kind of appealing because generalized coherent states, of which the ordinary canonical coherent states are a case, they enjoy a lot of classicality property. And in my mind, at least, it does make a lot of sense that unentangled states should be possessing more classicality features than entangled one. So it's kind of a nice connection to have. Now I'm going to come to the first check, the consistency check, which was touched upon, I think, in the two questions. So fine, we are free to give the definitions we are pleased, but what do we get out of these definitions in situations which have already been explored? And the first situation is supposed to go back to Alice and Bob, and the standard scenario, whereby standard scenario means that Alice and Bob have access to arbitrary local manipulation, local Hamiltonian, local measurements, and so on and so forth, which in this setting, I am reinterpreting as saying that the distinguished observables I am using to make contact with the generalized entanglement notion, they have to include arbitrary observables acting on either Alice or Bob separately. Algebraically speaking, it depends whether you prefer to think in terms of the Lie algebras or the corresponding Lie groups. For Lie algebra, you would have a direct sum of local algebras. For the group, it becomes a direct product. But what it physically means, if you prefer, is to say that the unentangled states, in this case, they are nothing but the orbit under the local SU dimension groups acting on a reference product state of your choice, which is perfectly equivalent to the usual definition. So in this case, it turns also out that naturally the way of reducing the state to take the reduced functional is nothing but the familiar partial trace on Alice and Bob that we always use in the situation. So what you can prove, although here is just a qualitative statement, is that standard entanglement, in the sense of having Alice and Bob bipartite and all the possible local capabilities included, is nothing but generalized entanglement relative to all the local observables. This doesn't have to be restricted to the bipartite case. Indeed, the generalization to the multipartite case is pretty straightforward, because if we now have, for instance, n qubits, doesn't even have to be qubits, but let's say it's n qubits, then all the local observables at the Lie algebraic level means that I am considering all the possible Pauli operators here acting on one qubit at a time. And if I consider, for instance, what that measure of purity relative to the algebra is in this case, we recover, although we didn't recognize it in the beginning, took us a while to figure out what it was, but this quantity here is nothing but the average subsystem purity that you can also compute by taking the rho square, the trace of rho square of each subsystem as an indicator of the purity, and average over all the possible purity of the possible subsystems. So what I want to stress is point number one, and I don't know how much or well this answered one question. If we have a bipartite structure to begin with, then assuming that we access fully locally the two parties, the two notions are completely equivalent, as they should be. Point number two, which was raised, is, well, what if we have access to arbitrary operators or arbitrary observables in the system? Then all states, all pure states, will be unentangled. They will be extremal under knowledge of all the possible expectation values of arbitrary operator in that state. What does it mean? Well, the way I like to think of this is that if I am given access to apply, for instance, arbitrary Hamiltonian or arbitrary measurement, I can interconvert any pure state into whatever other pure state of my choice. So it is only after a distinction between capabilities that are available and capabilities which are not, such as, for instance, local manipulation, that it becomes meaningful to categorize, to classify pure states into different orbits. But if all operators, including correlations, including whatever kinds of operators in here are accessible, then basically the notion of entanglement itself becomes kind of superfluous. Does it answer Alyosha a little bit? Yes. Okay. Now, yes, please. Yeah.
As a Lie algebra only?
Yes. In this case, I do mean a Lie algebra. It doesn't have to be. There is another setting in which you could have an associative algebra and the notion would still be true, but not the coherent state characterization.
But if we take the associate, the normal product, then we can regenerate the whole algebra from the. I mean, if we, in your case of two spin to halves, if I'm not mistaken, then if you assume these local observables, they generate, if you allow all the normal product, the operator product, not just the Lie product, then won't you regenerate the whole algebra for the full system?
No, because the operator in the, for instance, a local observable analysis would be of the form sigma Pauli tensor identity on both. And the ones acting on bar would be identity on Alice tensor sigma. So when you take the exponentiation, you basically have only local unitaries acting on them simultaneously. So you never get an observable which is like sigma x tensor sigma y.
Still a Lie algebra.
Yeah, but it would be not the local one. Yeah.
If you take the, I think what Raphael is saying is if you take the universal enveloping algebra, then you take a product of a local operator on Alice and a local operator on Bob, and you get an arbitrary operator.
Yeah, but I'm not taking the universal enveloping algebra, I'm just taking the algebra here for the observer. Otherwise, you get the full unrestricted case and
sure.
Can do everything.
But if you go to an associative algebra, right, then that's what you're doing. You're going to the universal enveloping algebra, and it's no longer local.
Yes, it's no longer local, but it wouldn't give you this definition here. What I'm saying is that in the associative case, you can give a definition of a generalized entanglement, but it's not the one that you would use to make contact with the standard definition. The standard definition is this, if you want to recall.
Is to a first approximation, we can just think Lie algebra when we're thinking about it.
In a lot of physically interesting situations, Lie algebra captures a lot of it. But for instance, if you want to work in convex cone settings, it's better to go with convex cones. And that is possible. Now, other example for Lie algebras, indeed. Just to make, so more or less, we have concluded that we can recover the standard definition. We actually get more out of this definition. And in particular, there are two examples that follow. This is the first example. The first example is just one where the Hilbert space under consideration is not decomposable because it has a dimension which is a prime number. So smallest case is a three-dimensional state space. Suppose I have a single spin one particle that carries a spin one irreducible representation of SU2 in terms of the familiar 3x3 angular momentum observables. Now, in this case, arbitrary operators which act on a three-dimensional space, algebraically speaking, we would have the SU3 algebra. Suppose that would be as large as possible, and relative to that, all the pure states would be unentangled in this notion. But suppose that, for instance, the distinguished observables are going to be linear in angular momentum observables.
Suppose, for instance, that the available capabilities you have are kind of a Stern and Gerlach type of experiments. Well, then you are physically selecting a subalgebra, which is SU2, and what I call the reduced state before is isomorphic to a list of three real numbers, the expectation values of the generators of angular momentum, subject to this constraint here, because we have a spin one particle. So all the reduced states, they are basically in one-to-one correspondence with points on a surface of a unit radius ball. And the points on the surface, indeed, are nothing but the spin coherent states. These are going to be the states that are going to be called unentangled relative to the SU2 observer. But if you take a state which is zero in the JC component, so it is right there in the middle of the sphere that I was talking about, that state is not a coherent state. That state is generalized unentangled, and it's generalized unentangled even though we just have an indecomposable system. What does it mean? I have something to say at the very end about it, but for now, what I want to say is that you can think of it being entangled relative to your capabilities, because if you start from the surface of the sphere, so you are in an unentangled state, you are in a coherent state, and you try to apply arbitrary unitary transformations in SU2, you'll never be able to take the state on the surface and interconvert into the state into the middle. Another way to see this is like, if I only give you access to expectation values of the JX, JY, and JZ, the state at the center of the ball is practically indistinguishable from a 50-50 mixture of states being pointing up and states pointing down. So these are two indications that it kind of makes sense to think of these as a maximally generalized entangled state. Alyosha.
Or with any resources, I think you would never be able to distill any better pair, right? Because we are used to think that if you have something entangled, then there must be something within your capability such that
this
you can get something.
This is an good question.
It's just the Corbin's, right, that we used to quantify.
Well, you would like, if you have one of the, indeed, the question that I will also pose in the end is like, if you have a notion of entanglement and you have states which you claim to possess entanglement, what useful task can you do that you couldn't be doing otherwise? So can you distill out things? Can you, I don't have an answer for this.
Because if you give the example C5, C5 is sort of still very in this category, right? Because it's not decomposable.
Okay.
Okay. Fine. But, so in C5, the subspace at C4, which is decomposable, and if I have access to all the C4, of course, I can produce entangled pairs. So I would say, oh, yes, then every time you generalize the entanglement, to some extent you also have some kind of entanglement that can be translated in web pairs. But the C3 is puzzling me because
C3
there is no
is
way
puzzling, and people have tried, including Paolo Zanardi, for instance. He was very skeptical about this particular example, and he tried to see that one way to see the three-dimensional state space is to say, okay, I can embed it in a four-dimensional state space of two fictitious qubits and restrict to the symmetric space.
Uh-huh.
But you are enlarging the state space, so that means that you give yourself some extra capability. I wouldn't go that path. There is another piece of evidence that I can add, however, and piece of evidence is that it turns out that the spin one states, some other group, Kliatchko, Shumovsky, and collaborators, they have been looking at non-classicality features of spin one, and turns out that states which are not coherent states, or in particular the one in the middle, they violate a Bell-type inequality that they derived, and I found out recently myself, it's a 2008 paper, and they deem them to be non-classical in the sense of violating something which they call the pentagram inequality. So there are some non-classicality features even there, and Rob.
Maybe I'm misunderstanding, but here you're talking about a resource theory where
I'm just talking about the definition for now. I don't have a complete picture of resource.
But implicitly what comes for free here is
SU2
rotations on a three-dimensional Hilbert space.
Yeah. This is actually the cheap one. Yes.
In the traditional Alice and Bob definition of entanglement, what comes for free is LOCC between two distant places. So I mean the entanglement here is, I think, really it's not related directly to the Alice and Bob kind of entanglement. So EPR pairs, I don't think, are...
No, indeed. They're very different. But I took Alyosha's question as, like, can you have a non-classical? I wouldn't try to distill out EPR pair out of this, because it's just not the way...
From this not, but from C5, you could.
But then...
Because you can just produce them.
You could, but that's not the relevant question,
right,
if you want to stick to the... to the capabilities that you might have intrinsic here. So, I think maybe we should move on a little bit and then see how it goes. So the second example is similar to this, and is actually two spin one half, just to make another kind of simple but perhaps puzzling observation. And if I take two spin one half particles, there are at least two notions which are now. First of all, if I view this as Alice and Bob, so that means that I give myself all the local capabilities on there, then I can recover, if I want, the usual definition of entanglement between two spin one degrees of freedom. But if I, for instance, insist in restricting myself to only angular momentum observables on either of the two parties, then I am working in a subalgebra, and in this case, it is possible to have states which have manifestly a tensor product structure in the way that they are written down mathematically, but nevertheless, they can have a non-zero amount of generalized entanglement relative to the observer on hand, to the SU2 observer. So that's just the other consideration I wanted to make. And I think it's almost, so it's three? Okay. Well, what I wanted to do in the second part is to get more technical and show you some of the application that this has allowed, this notion has allowed to do. Let me give you a preview at least, and then we can leave the application in detail for discussions. This is something which so far has allowed us to do certain things and leaves a lot of other questions open for investigations. What I like to stress about it is that this notion, in some sense, has naturally allowed to connect together different features of what I put under quotes here, complexity of quantum states and classicalities of quantum states. For instance, in terms of one of our original motivations was indeed coming from condensed matter systems and indistinguishable particles. looking at entanglement as directly being dependent upon expectation values of observable gives a very natural definition of entanglement in fermion degrees of freedom. Boson also, however, they are mathematically more tricky because they are infinite dimensional. Fermions are slightly easier to handle mathematically. So with that, that notion turns out to be independent upon whether you want to look at your system in fermions or spin or whatever language you might want to use. With that, turned out to be possible is to actually use the purity, the entanglement notions and measures to probe aspects of complexity in many body states, either ground states of interacting many body systems, in particular in connection with the problem of finding indicators, for instance, of quantum phase transitions, if you look at ground states, or another thing that turned out to work quite well is to find out how typical entanglement properties relative to a certain observer behave, and that has implication for pseudorandomness and quantum chaos. And that was meant, this is in blue, because I meant telling you in more detail about this, but I don't think I will have the time, not at least as part of the colloquium. There are other aspects that I want to mention about, and this is, I think, a very suggestive result that was proved by Rolando and co-workers, and that goes back to one of the open problems, what is the role of entanglement in determining computational speedup? So what in this paper people have been able, they have been able to show is that generalized entanglement can also help in understanding a little bit better where power comes from, in the sense that you can define a class of quantum computational models which they call Lie algebraic, whereby you start from an initial state and the allowed gates are constructed and measurements, they are constructed out of operation in a Lie algebra, and they could rigorously prove that unless the amount of entanglement relative to the Lie algebra would not be larger than a certain bound, then the resulting quantum computational model would be efficiently simulatable classically. So that extends a lot and ties together, I think, a lot of results for Q-state, at least, computation in a broader setting. And then there are two other highlights that I wanted to give. This is more related to work that Howard Barnum and also collaborators here, they have been doing on generalizing cloning and broadcasting to probabilistic theories. Turns out that the set of states, which for instance are able to be clonable and broadcastable in these generalized frameworks, they can be viewed as being unentangled relative to an appropriately defined observer. And lastly, the other point that I have here, you may say, I have mentioned that in the Lie algebraic setting, for instance, unentangled states, they are coherent states. They are generalized coherent states. They are most classical. For instance, they have minimum uncertainty properties. Classicality can also be defined, or at least the decoherence problem has defined classicality as an emergent property that comes from interaction with the environment. So how do, for instance, the classicality properties of entanglement and the definition that I've given tie together? Well, there is another work that has been possible to do showing that unentangled states, the algebraic state, coherent states, they can naturally emerge as pointer states, as most robust in a certain class of Markovian decoherence models. So that enforces the fact that they have, to some extent, some classical properties. Or if you look at that upside down, that entangled state in this definition have non-classical features. And with that, since, if you want to know what question to ask me, the three problems that I planned to, and I'm still here until Friday, so you can come by and we can discuss these things, I was planning, although that was a little bit utopistic, to tell you in detail about fermionic entanglement and generalized entanglement and to show you how this is a physically natural definition in the context of indistinguishable particles and apply that to detection of both, for instance, static
quantum phase transitions, this is a one-dimensional XY model in a transverse alternating fields with different universality classes. And then one of the things I'm doing in research these days is dynamical quantum critical phenomena, non-equilibrium. And what this figure shows, just to advertise a little bit, is that generalized entanglement are relative to a certain set of fermionic observables does obey a dynamical universal scaling with respect to certain parameters. And then the other problem that I extracted was typicality in a generalized entangled sense. I'm sure you know all about the Page conjecture for the typical entanglement of a subsystem. Well, we can ask, what is the typical entanglement if I have a system and I pick at random pure states, random according to the appropriate measure, which is induced by the hard measure. I have my distinguished observable set. Can I compute what the typical amount of entanglement, the expectation value of that will be? And we can. And that is useful to test and to probe, for instance, random states. They emerge naturally in non-integrable quantum systems. And these were some data that I could discuss in detail with people interested on how we have used this measure in disordered and also clean non-integrable system. So let me just make it to the conclusion and then open the floor for further questions. Our motivation was mainly to find a broader and larger physical and mathematical framework for talking about entanglement, which could be made meaningful to an arbitrary set of physically preferred observables. And I'm not claiming that this has to be the final answer at all. I just view this as a step in the direction of making this notion really tied to what we can do and we can find out about the state and define entanglement accordingly. There are, as I mentioned already, but there are really lots of questions that should and hopefully will be investigated more. Classicality is a word that I mentioned several times. I already talked about Bell's inequalities. One could ask, well, if one has generalized entangled state, does it mean that there are or there have to be inequalities that will be violated necessarily, or how does it go? I don't have a question, but this is the paper I was mentioning before in response to Alyosha's point. What they have here apparently is a state dependence, is a little bit of a strange thing, inequality that is violated for all but the generalized coherent state of a system with spin one. Now, the whole aspects related to resource theory, generalized LOCC maths, we have partial results on how to generalize them, but there are lots of these theories to be built, basically. And just as a tiny partial result of things that one could do, thinking about tasks that entanglement makes possible that couldn't be possible otherwise, what we have tried to do with Sergio Boixo, now he's in Caltech, previously at UNM, is to try to see whether generalized entangled states could allow better parameter estimation. And they do for Lie algebraic channel in an appropriately defined limit. But that's a tiny result. There is a lot of questions to be asked here. Lastly, and this goes back to my own personal interest when I was doing PhD, I was working with gravitation and in particular, extensions of quantum mechanics in pure space-time. One of the things that I think might be interesting is like the role of observers is very prominent and somehow crucial in non-inertial frames. I would be curious to ask whether this notion of entanglement has anything to say at all in that direction. And I was talking to Yvette Fuentes-Schuller about using this kind of framework to revisit the Alice and Bob falling into a black hole picture and see what it gives us. but I have nothing. This is just one direction I'd like to look at. Some references, and sorry about the time, and thank you for the attention and the questions.
So if I can ask if you take omega to be the complete set of observables,
yes,
then no state is generalized entangled.
That's good. No pure state, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I was just wondering, if it makes sense to ask, what's the minimal omega I can pick such that no pure state is meaningfully generalized entangled?
In a algebraic sense, or, yeah, that's a very good question. What mathematical structure can we give to that? What are we allowed? What do you envision as the rule of the games? Because if it's Lie algebraic...
Well, what I was thinking originally was what set of observables, what's the minimal set of observables I could pick such that no pure state would violate any kind of Bell-type inequality with respect to those observables?
Assuming
that
seems
to be a very open question.
Yeah. I don't have inequalities to exhibit for arbitrary observers. It's just an open question.
But it's not obviously the case that the moment you move below the complete set of observables, states become general. There's some set of states that becomes generalized entangled.
I would say that in a Lie algebraic setting, if you have a spanning, it can be pretty easy to generate a full algebra. But I wouldn't know in more general convex forms, for instance.
I think the question is just for ordinary, just for ordinary quantum mechanics.
Yeah. If omega is a strict subalgebra of SUN.
Yeah.
Then there will exist.
Yeah, yeah. In that case, yeah, there will exist. Sorry. If you want to just take a strict inclusion at the level of a subalgebra test, then there will be always.
Okay.
But I thought that you meant, like, even, for instance, countable sets?
Yeah. That's...
In which case, I don't know. Yeah.
I have a comment and a question. The comment is that it seems to me that you don't do justice to your work by calling this a theory of generalized entanglement, because I think that sort of promotes the confusion that this has something to do with that old bipartite scenario. And you just said this is a generalized theory of resources. I think it would be much clearer, because what you basically have is you specify at the beginning, here are the things that are free and easy to do.
Yeah.
And then we want to know, if you have a state that I can't prepare, well, then that's a resource. And you want to measure how much of the resource
it is. I'll address the comment in a second.
Now, the question is, there's sort of another kind of obvious way of trying to quantify an arbitrary resource. And I wonder if you've thought at all about the connection between it and your way, which is, suppose you figure out exactly what the full set of states that are easy to prepare under your free set of operations. And then for any other given state, you can try to calculate the distance to the set of free states using something like the relative entropy distance.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that also related to the measure of the geometric entanglement of looking at distances from sets which are easy to prepare? And
the idea is similar, but using different distance measure.
Yeah. We focused on observables rather than states, but yes, it would be interesting to see whether you get a similar perspective, or at least you can map one to the other, and then which one is better. And we haven't thought in terms of set of states so far.
Maybe the advantage of going with the geometric measure is that it's sort of obvious how you do it for mixed states. Is it clear how you generalize your thing?
The definition is clear. The quantitative aspects are not easily, the definition is clear in the sense that once you have a definition of a generalized unentangled pure states, then you would naturally extend and say that a state is generalized, a mixed state is generalized and entangled if it is
expressible as a convex mixture of generalized and entangled Q-states. So the definition is okay, it's just the usual convex extension. But that means, for instance, that if you want to have measures, the purity that I have mentioned, you would have to extend normally using the convex roof, which means that for practical purposes, and it is true of other measures as well, it is not necessarily easy to compute. But yeah, there aren't, in principle, the definition can be given for generalized entangled mixed states. Now, in regard to the topic, the name, we have been thinking a lot what to call these things or not. And the reason why we still stick to the idea of entanglement is because it incorporates all of the usual entanglement with the usual tensor product. If the mathematical structure of this distinguishable observable is the usual one which supports the tensor product decomposition of subsystems. So that for us, is not something which has nothing to do with that. It is a special case that is in there. So that's why we are being called this
way. You could call it generalized non-classicality, for instance, particularly with respect to the Schrodinger quote, because he said this is the essential feature that separates the quantum world from the classical world being entanglement. And you're finding something like this here.
You might want to apply in a more general context, where the things that are easy and free aren't necessarily classical in any sense.
I would like that, but I don't know if it would save me from problems, because it's a loaded word, classicality. But there was a question back there, and then,
So does anything new happen, or no problems if you extend this to infinite dimensions, or have you looked at that? Do you think it's straightforward, or what?
Mathematically, I think it's not as straightforward, but it would be very interesting to take seriously, because, for instance, for bosonic modes, there is at least one case which has to be recovered rigorously, which is the one of the canonical coherent states, but we haven't worked a lot with infinite dimensional state spaces.
So if you come to do quantum field theory, you'll be in infinite dimensions?
Yes, absolutely. I hope it will be either do it or definitely. We need more people working out lots of questions. Probably.
So following up on what Rob mentioned, there's recent work that, to me at least, really sort of justifies the use of relative entropy by looking at regularized entanglement. And inherent to the information theoretic notion of entanglement and the information theoretic applications is this idea that you want to measure entanglement by a measure that makes sense when you stack up many, many, many copies of the state in question. Mm-hmm. And there's a couple of papers that have shown that when you do that, relative entropy of entanglement, the geometric distance to a separable state measured by relative entropy, is kind of the only measure that actually works, that behaves well under regularization. So my question is, does regularization, i.e. measuring quality of states by taking many, many copies of them, is that a natural notion in this framework or not?
Well, in some sense, the need for many copies is intrinsic in the operational scenario that I have been hinting at. That is, I've said, I'm taking expectation values of observables, and expectation values of observables, they kind of require access to either an ensemble of identically, you have an ensemble system and you make weak measurements or something like that. Or an ensemble of identity prepared and repeated quantum processes. But I don't think that's you meant in the sense of asymptotic versus.
And regular old EPR entanglement has plenty of single copy applications like teleportation.
Right. Don't have any answer. But looking at the distance measures and the set of states, certainly something that. We
Just In terms of the kind of generalized entanglement without subsystems,
yes,
that you mentioned.
Yes.
I mean, what springs to mind immediately, therefore, is contextuality.
Yes.
So if you have the set of context, a set of observables for mm-hmm. demonstrating the contextuality of some observables on a quantum system, are the corresponding states?
I think that this, if my reading of that recent PRL, which is last year that I mentioned by Kulachko and co-workers, if my reading is correct, what then more after is really that contextuality. But as far as I also understood, that is specific to certain systems, so I don't know if this could be generalized to any setting for which generalized entanglement would be defined. For that paper, it is P1. So it would be definitely, I learned myself about this not too long ago, and that's not my work.
Thank you.
Sure.